Welcome to Just Us and the Climate, a podcast by the Climate Justice Coalition, where we bring climate change back down to earth and show how it's not only a crisis, but an opportunity to build a better and more just world.
Good day, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Just Us and the Climate. I'm your host today, Alex Linferna, the General Secretary of the Climate Justice Coalition. And we're very fortunate to be joined by Trevor Shaku, who is the national spokesperson of the South African Federation of Trade Unions. And the discussion for today is a really important and crucial question for South Africa, which is around our electricity future and the big moves that are underway to reform our electricity sector, arguably in order to open it up to the private sector through proposals such as unbundling and the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill, which is currently, you know, in front of the president, I think, as we speak. So thank you very much, Trevor, for joining us to have this really important discussion.
Good day, Alex, and thanks for having us as the Federation. And we also must greet the listeners of the Climate Justice Coalition podcast. We hope to have a very interesting discussion with you.
Fantastic. To maybe kick things off, Trevor, I think we like to start these podcasts with maybe getting a little bit of a sense of who we're talking to and what drives them. And so a bit of an icebreaker question is, you know, what drew you to trade unionism and the sort of activism around it? What roles have you played in this space? And why do you think, I mean, the topic of today's podcast is looking at the unbundling of Eskom and the Electricity Regulation Act and everything that's happening around that space. So why is it important for trade unions and trade unionists to be weighing in on issues like that?
Look, personally, I come from the student movement. Mm. And there I was a student activist who was part of the Fees Must Fall. Yeah. And the outsourcing must fall. And I think that's where I met the working class. But of course, I would have met the working class as a movement in theory through the Marxist literature. And through that, I was able to adjust in the battles we had against the university managements, where we're fighting for insourcing of those workers, improvement of working conditions, and achievement of a decent wage. And because of that experience, when I entered the workspace, the first workspace, of course, was at the university, just as a research assistant. But beyond that, I became a teacher, and I became a site steward, a branch secretary, and a regional secretary of the South African Democratic Teachers Union, SADU. Okay. And it is from there that I transitioned into being the spokesperson of SAFTU, the South African Federation of Trade Unions. Now, the South African Federation of Trade Unions, obviously, it is a national federation, and as a result, it deals with issues of workers from one sector to another across all the economic sectors, both in the private and in the public sector. And the issue of energy in particular, which will be the subject of today's discussion, is very important and central to the economy, but also to the lives of the ordinary working people, because we can't survive without energy, especially in the context of the kind of economy we've had. In fact, even if we were to go back to the ancient times, you'll realize that energy has always been central, even to, for instance, to the growth of the human brain. We are told that one of the key ingredients to the human revolution or the biological revolution in the human species has been the ability of those hominids to be able to discover fire and be able to roast or cook some meat out of it, which would have given them protein. So this shows you that even historically, energy is important, and energy in all senses. Yeah, so I think this is the basis for which, as the trade union movement, the issue of energy becomes quite central, because it is central anyway to the lives of everybody. And for an economy which is capital intensive and is, if you were to look at the capital to labor composition, you realize that this economy of South Africa is capital intensive. And because it's capital intensive, it requires energy for those factories to be able to be powered, for those mines to be able to to continue to operate and in the main produce the value. Energy is central and important to the trade union movement.
Nice. Yeah, that's really helpful. And I think, you know, basically energy is the lifeblood of an economy, and how it flows, who it flows to, how it's governed, whose interests it serves are also key questions for trade unions, given that, you know, a big fight for trade unions is to ensure that the working class interests are represented, that workers' interests are taken care of. So when we see what we see now by the government, big moves to reform the electricity sector.
Yes.
And so big forms, in other words, to reform how the lifeblood of the economy flows. And so maybe we can begin to dive into what those big moves are and why trade unions, and particularly SAFTU, is worried about them.
Sure.
So I guess the first questions are, what is unbundling? If you could help us unpack or unbundle what unbundling is. And then how does it relate to this Electricity Regulation Act amendment? And maybe as you're explaining it, you're welcome to say why SAFTU is worried or what you reject about it. If there's things that are positive in it that you see, feel free to.
Sure. So the history of the electricity sector, in particular in this country, has been dominated by public ownership through Eskom. And Eskom, when it was established as a vertically integrated company, which has three divisions embedded in it: generation, where production of electricity is taking place, and transmission, the power lines, and the transportation of the electrons, which would have been captured from the stations and transporting them to where they would be used, and distribution, of course, which is merely just the last part of that transmission, because it is about taking these electrons out of the power lines to get into the homes, factories, so that they can be able to be utilized. So you have such an integrated, vertically integrated company. So then unbundling is mainly a term that explains the dismantling of this domination or of this vertical pattern of our company called Eskom. So what they want to do is to separate these functions from one another, so that they are no longer embedded in one company, and that various other role players could come and play roles. And in this instance, they are, of course, inviting the private sector. I'll deal with this at a later stage. So the unbundling involves this separation of production. So production should take place somewhere alone. This transmission should be owned by a certain company and take place somewhere alone, and distribution. Now, the implications of this is that you still can have unbundling with public ownership, but the current unbundling that is taking place in this country, it is not embracing public ownership or the continued ownership of energy provision by the public. Right. What it actually has incorporated is the vision for private ownership, so that there could be private role players in this market who are able to take part in the generation, and who can also take place either in transmission and even in distribution. But at the current moment, they are not intending, the private players, they are not intending to play a role in the transmission. What they want to play a role in is in the distribution and in the production, but more so in the production. And that's where we've seen most serious strides which have been made by government in making concessions to capital, private capital, to begin to take and play a role in that. In fact, in one plan they presented to us in the Presidential Climate Commission, where they were consulting with the trade union movement, they brought an Eskom rep who showed us the unbundling plan over the next 10 years, or rather 12 years, because it is a 2035 plan. So they are planning that in 2035, the end of the unbundling should have transferred energy production, that is generation, from Eskom to the private sector, of about 66.66%. That is the two-thirds. That means the two-thirds should have been transferred and should at the time be produced by the private cabinet. Now, in distribution, they envision that that unbundling will even go further than two-thirds. It would be three-fourths. In other words, 75% of what currently is delivered by the public sector in the form either of municipalities or ESCOM itself, but it would have been transferred into private entities. So this is the current trajectory for which unbundling has taken, and it is because of the willingness of government to auction generation of electricity to the private sector and also auction the selling of electricity to the people in the distribution market to the private sector.
Thanks for that. That's a really helpful explanation of the unbundling process. And I think, you know, when you speak to a lot of South Africans, they get frustrated with the way that the state is operating. And so I think maybe part of what would be helpful is for us to explain why that opening up of the private to the private sector, not just the opening up, like the possible domination that the private sector will have in the future, is such a worry for SAFTU.
Sure. So the opening up of the private sector to these aspects of energy provision in the country is very worrying indeed to the South African Federation of Trade Unions. Firstly, because as a matter of principle, we favor public ownership. And we do not just favor public ownership merely because it's a principle. We actually enshrined it in as part of our principles because we believe that public ownership is not geared towards any profit making because there's no profit motive behind that. In other words, even if they were to levy, say, for instance, some prices on services or goods produced under the ownership of public, they would not necessarily be aiming at making and maximizing profits. It would be for the survival of that particular company. So in the main, the goal is to achieve the delivery of a particular service or the production of a certain good, which of course will again benefit the public. So if you were to take then the history of ESCOM, because if you actually are to look at the history of ESCOM and the role that ESCOM continuously has to play, you'll realize actually the very gist of our worry, or you at least reckon the very gist of our worry. And this is because when ESCOM was published as a, was established as a public entity, it was not geared towards profit. And as a result, it was seen as an organ that will help the state to develop, the country to develop economically, in ensuring that the energy-intensive economic activities such as mining are able to take place. The economic, the electricity-intensive economic activities such as smelting are able to take place, and at lower costs for that matter. But secondly, you also have a population that require energy in their own homes. And as a result, you need those people because they are the very people who produce the labor that has to come to work and work in those electricity-intensive factories. You need them to be well-fed, and in order for them to be well-fed, they have to have cooked or rather boiled water or something. So you need energy to power both. So in the main, if you are envisioning that the production and provision of electricity ought to be public, you recognize the fact that it has to prop up the whole of society, both for their economic activities and even just for their social leisure. Now, if you bring the private element, the private sector with its profit motives into the equation, you are going to end up with a serious problem. And that problem is that you now are going to have to increase prices in accordance with the motives of profit maximization. And that may be and would be in this country unaffordable to many. Already we know that there is an imminent problem we are faced with in the energy space, and that is energy poverty. Mm. Now, as SAFT, we identified two things, that main two things, not the only things, but the main two things which contribute to the energy poverty. The first one is access to the grid. And the issue of access to grid is, by the efforts of government since 1994, really we see progress there, because from connecting a small number of households in 1994 to now having connected about 91% of the households, that is a serious inroad, which I think must be commended. But what it shows is that we still have 9% who are excluded from the grid, and we are contributing to the energy poverty of such particular households because of the failures of government to electrify each and every household. Because there's indeed no justification as to why they've not achieved that. They've had their tears, and we think that had they been able to not be derailed by fiscal austerity measures or corruption that has derailed their projects in housing and elsewhere across the areas of social provision, they would have actually connected every household to the grid. But on the other side, you have affordability as one of the main factors that contributes to the energy poverty. Now, what does this affordability speaks to? It speaks to, firstly, the amount of, but the price that is levied on the electricity. Now, if the amount or the tariff that is levied on the electricity grows higher each and every time because we are chasing after profit margins, it means that we will be leaving a huge majority of South African population behind in terms of affording electricity. We are currently speaking at a time when we have 75% of the South African workforce earning less than 5,800, according to the Stellenbosch Research Group, BERS, which, of course, they produce those studies in connection and in collaboration with the First National Bank, FNB. They've published this statistic at the end of 2022. But we know that there is a significant majority, or rather minority, in the workforce that also is earning less than a minimum wage. Now, if we were to take the Pietermaritzburg Dignity Justice Economic Group, which does research on the and produce a research report called the Household Affordability Index, we will see there that just the cost of household grocery on food alone, leaving domestic hygienic products, leaving personal hygienic products, leaving your clothes, excluding transport, excluding fuel, just on food alone, the cost of such particular basket is higher. Now, if the cost of such basket is higher and you have the profit motives that are driving eventually, because this is the plan, have profit motives by the private sector will be generating the electricity in the next, say, 10 years, a huge of it, you then are going to have problems, because it means that these people are not going to be able to afford and keep up with the tariffs that are being hiked. In fact, as we speak already, we have that particular problem. We have estimations, I think, published in the Climate Justice Coalition's Green Eskom booklet, where they show the graph that measures the increase in the electricity tariff since 2007. Now, if you have a unit cost of electricity costing 37 cents in 2007, but today it is costing more than 2 rands, that is more than 400% increase in real terms. And that's problematic, because what it means is that people are being excluded from this as a result of electricity tariffs. And here, we're not even being driven by profit motives. Now, imagine if we would be driven by the profit motives. It would mean that constantly the energy generating companies have to increase the tariffs in order to improve their profit margins and rake in profits.
Yeah, thanks for that. I think it's a really important reminder that when we think about electricity, in many ways it's a public good, and it's about using electricity to develop the state, to ensure that we are, you know, serving people that may not be able to afford, particularly in the South African context, where, you know, the vast majority are poor, working class. And so if things are handed over to the private sector, then there's a real worry that they'll get left behind, particularly also in terms of who can afford to invest in renewable energy generation, for example. It's those already who have capital that will be able to take advantage. Whereas if you have a more public sector approach, that means that, you know, that might shift who can invest and benefit from those that transition. And I think that brings me a little bit to, you know, what would SAFTU's positive vision be? I think we see that there's this unbundling process that's going on, and I think that's being formalized under the Electricity Regulation Act amendment, right?
Sure.
And I think, I mean, firstly, there's a lot of uncertainty about what exactly this Electricity Regulation Act amendment's going to do, because it's a vast, like, reform that's going to happen. I've been speaking to some people, and lots of people that are even energy experts are a little bit confused about what exactly is going to be the end run of this act. And I think this is really worrying. It's like on the cusp of being passed, and there's so many uncertainties. But maybe we can speak, I mean, if you want, you can comment on the uncertainties around the Electricity Regulation Act, but also what SAFTU's positive vision in contrast to that.
So SAFTU made a parliamentary submission on the Electricity Amendment Regulation Bill. And the gist of that submission was we identified the insertions into the act that are merely going to establish a legal framework for the introduction of capital, private capital, in the energy generation space, and make that legal framework accommodate the future liberalized competitive markets, as they would say. So in other words, it is a legal framework for the liberalization of the energy markets. Now, already the reform was taking place, but there was no legal framework for it, because if we look at when the first bid window took place, it took place in 2011. And this bid window came in at a time when there had not been any adjustments in the Electricity Regulation Act. And because there were no adjustments, I think they realized that they may run into problems with the law, and people, I mean, civil society organizations, including trade unions, who are against privatization, may in fact even take them to court. So they realized we're going to have to create a legal framework for this political economy of privatization. Because what is happening there is just the legalization of privatization in that particular act. So, for instance, if you look at there's an insertion in Section 15. Now, that insertion talks about allowing for a reasonable return, which is commensurate with the risk of the license activity. Now, what is that license activity? It would be, of course, generation of electricity. It could be through renewables. It could be through fossils, because they still allow those fossils to be part of the bid windows. So, in the main, if a company therefore comes bid, win the bid, and then is contracted to provide, say, 2,000 megawatts of electricity or 200 megawatts of electricity, that is the license activity that they are talking about. Now, when they say they are going to allow for a reasonable return commensurate with the risk, is the consideration of the risks in that particular economic activity. Now, what are these particular risks that they are talking about? By the way, when they inserted this, is not a new invention. It is just what they are already practicing, but made into law. Because what they are already practicing, we have seen this with those bid window one, bid window two. If you check some contracts or the contracts they've struck, of course, most of them have been made secret and the public cannot be able to access them. But there's one or two economists who were able to access these things and broke them down. And this is where we get to. The first thing there is that they demand what we call a demand guarantee. Now, a demand guarantee is a form of what we call a de-risking measure. Because an economic activity does not guarantee that there will be buyers of the end product of that activity, you are going to be running a risk, therefore, of making losses if you do not have the market, if you do not have people to buy that. Mm. So they then force government into locked-in clauses, which forces it to guarantee demand. Mm. That even if, for instance, it was to produce enough electricity, and even in excess, and people would not be consuming such electricity, government is obliged to buy that electricity from them. Mm. So this is what allowing them a reasonable risk of return means. But also, this is going to be, of course, even in the future, where we know that they are running away from the risks. And this is where, again, by the way, our criticism comes in. Mm. We have been told that capitalism and entrepreneurship are all about risk-taking. Yeah. If anything, if you read Ludwig von Mises, Frederick von Hayek, and all of the classical pro-capitalist ideologues, you'll come across one and one thing only, that the businesses are about taking risks, and that is the reason why when they justify profiteering and payouts of huge dividends, they usually cite the fact that I am the one who took the risk. Yeah. So now they are no longer about risks, because with this particular clause that has been inserted in Section 15, what they are saying is that they should be emulated from the risks of the market. In fact, they are defeating the very purpose of why capitalism is necessary, according to them. They are actually even defeating the very purpose of why they say they must be allowed to be introduced into the market. Because their argument, again, is that we will bring capital, we will be able to take that particular risk. But they are not taking risk because, in fact, at the end of the day, it is government that is footing this bill. Mm. Now, when I say that this is not a new thing, but it's already something that is being practiced, but because they fear maybe litigations in the future, they want to legalize it, there's proof for what I'm saying. If you look at the National Treasury medium-term budget policy statement documents, you go to contingent liabilities, where they list their state-owned enterprises or whatever may actually pose what we call fiscal risks to the budgeting of a particular financial year or of a particular medium-term expenditure framework, you will find that they actually have guaranteed the companies, the IPPs, the independent power producers, which are the private companies that have won in the previous bid windows, they've guaranteed them up to the tune of 179 billion. Mm. Now, if they've guaranteed them, it means that should they run into a risk, government will pay out. In other words, they don't have to incur that the cost of that particular risk, because government will be able to take care of that particular. So we are opposed to this Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill, first on the basis of this insertion. There are other sections which perhaps we could deal with at a later stage, which includes the question of the market structure, the creation of the market structure. They have what they call the TSMO or the TSO, which is the Transmission System Operator. This is mostly, this company has already been established. Mm-hmm. It is a company which was envisioned in the unbundling process that it will be a government-owned entity that controls the transmission. Mm. Remember, I said transmission, distribution, generation. So the transmission, they've made a it's not even a concession. They want, the private sector, want transmission to be held by government, because they know there are also risks in that. Remember, in transmission, there's not much of a return, actually. Because once you've established those power lines, yours is just to maintain them. Okay. There's no value really created. It is a transportation of value, but it's not a creation of value. In other words, there's lesser incentive for making a return out of the power lines. That's why they want government to be the one that owns them. Mm. And they've gone, of course, government has gone on even to implement this. They've established the National Transmission Company last year in October, I think 2022, but the license was pre-approved in June. And I think in October there was another, not necessarily a final approval, but there was some approval by the regulators in the in the South African economic space and company space. So the establishment of this company will have embedded in it an agency called the Central Purchasing Agency. Mm. The Central Purchasing Agency will be responsible for buying electricity from the producers of the generators of electricity. In this instance, if you recall my earlier presentation of what ESCOM would have presented to us in the Presidential Climate Commission, is that 66 produced by private sector, 33 produced by government. In other words, government, together with the private companies that would be producing 66% of the electricity, will then be selling this electricity to the central purchasing agency, which is embedded within the transmission system operator. And the system operator will transmit that electricity through the distribution companies. And in this instance, they still have a role, of course, for municipalities, and they have a role for the private sector companies. So this is parts of the, if you read all of it and you summarize it in a nutshell, we can just say that Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill is a legal framework for the privatization of the energy provision and the liberalization of the energy markets.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So it's kind of two parallel processes. One is the unbundling's happening already, right?
Sure.
And so in some sense, that's already quite far down the road. But then the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill is to kind of formalize the legal process of that and to really open things up to the private sector. And I'm curious here, because SAFTU is taking quite a strong stance on this, what has the engagement with other federations and trade unions been like on this? Are they also coming out against the unbundling, or is there a little bit more of a mixed sense across the federations on this front?
Sure.
Yeah.
Look, on the face value, there seems to be synergy across the trade union federations as to what is it that we want. We all are opposed to the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill. In fact, when we were making our presentation in Parliament last year, I think on the 5th of November, COSATU also made their presentation and they opposed it. An affiliate of COSATU, NUM, also made a presentation and opposed it. Our affiliate, I think, NUMSA, also made a presentation and opposed it. What I did not see, of course, was FEDUSA, unless I arrived late in the meeting, but I didn't see FEDUSA's presentation. So this is what, at face value, and at least in the writings, it shows that we are all opposed to the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill, or generally what the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill seeks to codify into law, because what that piece of amendments are trying to do, those pieces of amendments, what they're trying to do is just to codify the political economy of liberalization of energy. So we are opposed to that. But there has not been really a serious move on the part of all the federations, including SAFTU, to take to the streets to oppose the passing of that law.
Right.
We are 6 months later since the presentations were made, and in fact, I think 4 months later, the bill was signed into law.
Right.
And so, but nonetheless, none of us actually rose up to oppose it. But I know that NUM and NUMSA have consistently in the past, even before this, have always been fighting and even taking to streets to fight against the privatization of energy provision through the introduction of the independent power producer as early as the last decade. So this is the, insofar as the trade union federations are and, and their affiliates. But there's not much, really, which concretely we would have done, except those submissions.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, and I think this, from a strategy perspective, this raises some interesting questions.
Sure.
Given that unbundling seems to be quite far down the road, right? And so if we're thinking about progressive forces that might want to push for maybe a, more of a public pathway approach, do you think there's still time to push back against that? And what would be a good strategic way, I think, of building that? And maybe this could also speak, because I know that SAFTU has been working with trade unions for energy democracy for
sure.
an alternative public pathway approach. I don't know if you want to speak a little bit more sure. about the efforts there.
No, thanks very much. Sure. Because I forgot this in the earlier question when you requested me to also state the vision that that is in contrast with what government is implementing.
Right.
Look, our vision is encapsulated in the public pathway. And maybe let's break it down. What does it mean for us? The public pathway to energy provision requires, firstly, that we've got to save Eskom.
Yeah.
We've got to save Eskom and ensure that energy, a huge chunk of electricity in particular, is still produced and provided through Eskom.
Yeah.
And in fact, if anything, if we were to be able to save Eskom, we could even set it on a path of again clawing back all the space it has lost and maybe even rendering redundant some of the private players who are currently in that space.
Right.
So this is the first thing. The second thing is that this vision also, of course, is in light of the current form of Eskom, where it is, like trying to fight against the load shedding by saving its current fleet. Of course, we'll talk about this in a moment deeply. But the second element of the public pathway then is about ensuring that because the future is renewables, we therefore have to ensure that the introduction of renewables should not be championed through the REIPPP program. The Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Procurement Program.
Yeah.
It should be...
Which is the public-private procurement.
Yes, yes. It is actually a belt for them to bring these IPPs onto this and the private capital into the energy program. So what we are aiming for with this strategy and solution of ours is that since the future is renewables, therefore... do away with renewable energy independent power producer procurement program and invest in the green new Eskom, which would be an Eskom that has built greater capacity for production of electricity through renewable sources. And many organizations, including a coalition, the Climate Justice Coalition, which SAFTU is part of, have put forward through a number of research resolutions the ways in which the capacity for renewable energy source exists in this country. So we have got to leverage the market and ensure that, leverage the space rather, and ensure that we are able to utilize the sun, utilize the winds where the winds are, the sun where the sun is shining brightly and throughout the year, and of course many other renewable sources that we can be able to use to ensure that it is Eskom that champions that, not any private company. So our public pathway as a result is in direct opposition to not only what government is doing but what the global forces are trying to impose on various countries. The IMF and the World Bank have been trying to impose onto countries, various countries, through their country partnership reports and recommendations in those reports. I mean, the IMF's Article 4 reports are always littered with those recommendations, saying that government's role must only be that of playing the role of creating an enabling environment for the private sector to be able to thrive. And through that, they say, we will be leveraging on the private capital that lies fallow somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a problem that they even make this concession that there's private capital lying fallow somewhere which is not being utilized to create value in society. So it brings us in contradiction with them.
Yeah.
For that reason, but secondly, because it means therefore that we are also opposed to the Just Energy Transition Partnerships, one which has been signed with South Africa, two which has been signed with Senegal, 3, I think with Argentina. 4, I think Indonesia. I know India was negotiating ease, and it might be improved one because it would have learned from the mistakes some other countries would have made. But we are opposed to those, not necessarily because of the principle of moving from fossils to renewable. No, we are not, of course, opposed to that. We are opposed to the Just Energy Transition Partnership on the basis that they create a political economy of privatization for the energy provision.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. I think it brings us to the international element of this, and there is a major international element of it. You know, we were having a conversation with some of those JETP partners, and it was quite interesting what they were saying. They were saying the UK, some of the UK folks, that no, we're not actually pushing for privatization. We're following the policy of the South African government, right? But then if you trace back, for example, some loans that the World Bank and the IMF gave to South Africa, part of the conditionalities in there are around things like unbundling, being part of what drives those loans. So even if it's not strictly in some of the JETP writing, it's predated into it, and then the JETP funding in a way enables that pathway to like deepen, essentially.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I think this also brings some questions, because if we see this as part of a global sort of almost structural adjustment program that the World Bank and the IMF is pushing forward, I think it also maybe brings the question of where have we seen successful resistance to this? Do we have good international examples where, you know, there's been the unbundling process that's being pushed on other countries, and there's been successful progressive possible counter-resistance and development of progressive public pathway alternatives? I don't know if you've seen too many examples of that, perhaps through the trade unions and energy democracy work.
Look, the collaboration we have through TUET is very key, because what it's doing, which, by the way, has been lacking, I think, throughout many trade union federations, is the capacity to develop such concrete, detailed research on the trajectory of the energy transition throughout the world, and coming to the realization that what actually is happening here is that there is no energy transition per se, but there is energy expansion.
Yeah.
That is, that in so much as they also are adding renewable energy power source, they are also adding fossil fuel sources into the grids. And you can go through many other countries, including China, UK, United States. You'll realize that as much as they were expanding on this side, they also were expanding their fossil capacity. Now, this is one enlightening, in the sense that we are even again able to isolate the hypocrisy of the so-called international capitalist class, which somehow has drastically and dramatically moved from being climate justice denialists to becoming advocates of the earth and climate. And there's nothing here except that they want to position themselves in the space of the transition to be able to use and leverage that as part of creating and maximizing their own wealth. One. Two, we are able through that to meet other like-minded trade unions which have not been captured by fossil interests, because there are those organizations that are captured by fossil interests, which continuously just want to deny anything and everything which tries to link the climate catastrophes with the fossil fuel and the global warming. So it is able to link us with that and enable us to realize that we can actually build a global resistant movement from the trade union movement, which would be very important. Of course, this global trade union movement that will fight against the political economy of the just transition, trying to save it away from the ownership by the private capital, will enable us also and must be linked necessarily with the other formations of the working class movement globally. So there's a need for that trade union coordination at the global level so that we are able to fight back. Because you see, the danger with trade unions is that they are part and parcel of the system. In fact, their very existence depends on the system. So it is quite easy to lose perspective on especially the political economy of the transition or whatever transformation we might be moving to. If it's, for instance, the production of a cheap product, cheap, they call them these chips which are used for AIs.
And the microchips.
Thank you very much. So in any of these transitions which are at the heart of new revolutions, industrial revolutions, we may tend to side with capital because inherently we are a byproduct of capital. So it is necessary for such particular a structure to exist like TUET, where we are able to discuss, especially at the core, because at the core of TUET is the evaluation of the political economy of the just transition and ensuring that we do not let it be driven by the private sector, but it is actually championed by the people for the interests of the people. And the organs of the people, the working class in particular, in the main organized would be the trade unions and of course other formations, but the most organized organs of the working people are the trade unions. So in that context, we are able to mobilize ourselves and be able to recognize these hypocrisies. And you know, it also, I mean, in these spaces where, because I've been there, it is easier also because, you know what it helps us to do? Quite often when we go to international platforms, we tend to be the spokespersons and representatives of our own national bourgeoisie. Like, we tend to speak in national interest terms.
Right.
But what are the national interest terms if not the interests of the ruling class? So we tend to take that. If you go to BRICS, let's say Trade Union Summit, you'll find, or AGOA Trade Union Summits or whatever, you'll find there that quite often trade unions tend to speak on behalf of the national bourgeoisie. And it's problematic. It's problematic. So an organization like TUET coordinating us into a coherent, cohesive force globally to resist the political economy of liberalization and privatization of energy is quite key. And I think it is moving proper. They met in Latin America now. They launched the Latin American section. The sub-Saharan section was launched in 2022, and they're launching in the Global South generally. But we are aiming at creating that global movement of trade unions for energy democracy.
Right, that's really exciting. I think building up that internationale is vital, particularly on an issue like climate justice, where, you know, it is a global issue. And if we are just, you know, some countries are leading and others are left behind, then we're not going to tackle the nature of a global crisis of the sorts. And so I think building that international solidarity is key. There was an example that I had in mind, actually, of, you know, a successful pushback against sort of the dominance of the private sector. And it was in New York State, actually. They did something called the Build Public Renewables Act. And there it's basically the aim of that act, and I think the trade unions were involved in fighting for this too, was that the public sector, the public utility, would be the one that would invest a large amount in renewable energy, and that there would be strong conditions in place to ensure that there's good labor standards. And I think in Washington State as well, in the States, they had a bill that they passed where they would ensure that it would unionize labor that would be part of building out renewables as well. So I think there are some examples out there where we see the pushback against the private sector domination. The question, I guess, was for how do we ensure that we get a bill like that here in South Africa passed rather than something like the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill?
You know, hey, that one will require a proper mobilization. And maybe even this actually draws us closer to the political question of who should rule, actually. I think that is unavoidable when we're dealing with this, because it is the ANC government that is driving these policies. The DA is most certainly going to push the same thing. The Action SA is certainly going to push the same thing. In fact, all those parties that have created what we call the multi-party charter, whatever.
Center-right, right-wing coalition.
In fact, they published a policy brief or a policy statement type of where they did on energy, where they just reaffirm the electricity regulation amendment bill, and then and the objectives codified in the in that particular act. So I saw what happened. I did read a little bit, although I did not read the entire act. But we actually shared it across to say these people are winning back and clawing back on against privatization on
this
the ownership.
The New York one,
on the ownership of the of the of the energy provision.
Yeah,
and this is maybe going to require ourselves to ally as trade unions with the working class movement generally to be able to fight back. But I don't know if without that fight back we can be able to win any concrete gain, especially if you consider that the same ruling party that will be fighting against is the one that recently introduced the same thing, which means that this is their long-term plan.
Yeah.
So they're not going to reverse it anytime soon except that they are forced.
Yeah.
And I think it would have to come out of that. However, there are lingering risks even for that movement, at least insofar as the South African trade union movement is concerned, because you have the biggest federation allied to the ANC.
Yeah.
And I think even most of these things, like really, they are not going to put much effort in that fight back.
Yeah.
Maybe they may join as soon as they realize that the movement is solid and worldwide, but it is contradictory for them because of that relation. It compromises them. But that relation also weakens, because quite often they are guided by it rather than by the interest of the working class.
Mm.
If you look at their reaction to many things, sometimes they just pay lip service to these issues that affect the working class, but there's nothing concrete that they are taking. Of course, one may ask, why is SAFTU and other federations then not doing the opposite? But there are dynamics which have, of course, even contributed to the weakening of the trade union movement, including in our own federations ourselves.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I see impeding the fight back against the privatization of energy provision is that, in the trade union movement at least, but the fragmentation of the working class itself generally has created problems. We have become a group of people who merely criticize one another, but are not able to work together to fight against common problems. And an issue of an privatization of energy provision, there's no ideological, smaller than ideological difference we will have. If we say we are against privatization, I mean, we should be able to unite on that. But somehow, some squabbles will divide us and people will not be participating. They'll be the first ones to lecture you on how you should have conducted the strike. And that's very problematic because instead of participating, they've become lecturers. So those are the weaknesses that have impeded and will continue to impede us from achieving the necessary cohesion in struggle to fight against privatization and to fight for the advancement of the interests of the working people.
Yeah. I think that's such an important point. The tyranny of small differences, especially amongst progressive less forces, can be such an obstacle to to change. And when we look at the political landscape, particularly as we move to elections now, we see that the majority of parties are kind of aligned, pushing this sort of privatization agenda. And so there should be a wake-up call that, you know, we do need to build united, cohesive, and strong forces to push back. And this may also be an opportunity not just to, you know, push back, but to rebuild as the progressive forces, because, you know, the threat is very real. So perhaps on that note, we can maybe close with any thoughts you have about how we can begin to build together, any calls to action that you'd like to put out there on this particular front, and if there's anything maybe you want to add that we haven't touched on in this conversation too.
Look, there's not much to add except to say that the current, so there's a need for the transition. And that transition in electricity sector must be linked with other transitions in the whole of the energy sector. In electric vehicles, we are left behind there. And but there's an opportunity that exists for us, which I think that should be leveraged by ourselves and push government to actually take, because there's a need for us, if we really take this thing serious, there's a need for us to ensure that we are also pushing transitions in other sectors and position ourselves. What I fear most is that, and this is what I think narrow trade unionists do not understand. What they do not understand is that whilst indeed we need to protect jobs, and we need to protect jobs in the electricity fossil sector, but you can't just hold there and not have any plans to transition.
Yeah.
In fact, we have passed the stage of plans. We need to begin moving forward. Right. So the problem that emerges here is that they are not reading the global developments. And the global developments, Comrade Alex, if you were to look at them and read them, they will tell you that even if you are an advocate of a fossil, let's say you don't have a problem with a fossil, you will still be forced to adjust. Let me tell you why. There are carbon border mechanisms which are being introduced by the European Union. And additional carbon tariffs that are added on various other types of products. Now, let's imagine, for instance, you are producing things and you rely on earning. So, for instance, to earn foreign income, which is necessary to do your trade, even through importing, you need to earn a certain amount of foreign reserves. And you earn mostly those foreign reserves through an economic activity, especially exportation. Now, if you have the dependence of earning those foreign reserves through exporting, and then they introduce the carbon tax, for instance, and because you refused to transition, your companies are going to suffer, because you are no longer, let me just actually give a tangible example. The manufacturing sector, the automotive manufacturing sector, is providing 508,000 jobs. Out of these jobs, it also contributes 5.7% to the GDP.
Right.
Then there is 67% out of all its total output, 60% is exported, which means the greater market for the production of those vehicles is not inside the country, but it's outside the country. This includes components, right? So if they introduce those carbon tariff, all of them, those measures, it would mean that the South African components and vehicle components and vehicles are no longer going to be competitive in the international market, because they will have added price because of the carbon tariffs that would have been added. Remember, the producers would not want to make losses. So what they would do is to take the tariff and transfer it or absorb it into prices, which would mean that the price of those products increase, and as a result, you are not able to sell competitively. In other words, what I'm trying to say, which is a logical conclusion out of this argument, is that you are going to start underperforming, and as a result, the very companies are going to start considering having to close. Who would be hit most when they close? It would be the same workers you were trying to save when you refused to transition. So we need to emphasize the just in the just energy transition, so that we do not oppose the transition just because we want to save jobs. In fact, the very insertion of the just is to save those jobs, is to ensure that there's reskilling, so that workers not even want, SAFTU has a principle that we support the transition on condition that no one job is lost. That in that transition, these people are reskilled and transferred into the new forms of companies and economic activities under renewables. So this is the position of SAFTU.
Yeah, thanks for that, Trevor. I think that's a really important note to end on, is that, you know, this transition is happening, and I guess the big question for us is on whose terms, right?
Now,
the terms that seem to be laid is the terms of capital.
Yes.
And this is what unbundling and the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill seem to be laying the foundations for, is that capital is going to dominate this transition. And what we need to be doing in response is ensuring that it's more of a transition that's on our terms, that puts justice central, that puts environmental justice, social justice, puts workers' interests at the core of it. And so I think this is a call to action, is recognizing the weakness of progressive forces now and the strength of capital. If we don't mobilize, if we don't actually get our act together, it's going to still be on capital's terms, and indeed, that's not going to serve us, right?
Indeed. No. It's not going to be just, actually. And I think that's the point where one maybe needs to just emphasize that we must be clear that if the transition is driven by the private sector, it is not going to be just. So we've got to fight for the public pathway in the just transition, or the just transition to take the route of a public pathway. That is the only way we're going to ensure that the interests of the working people are taken care of, the interests of the communities where these fossils are dug or where these stations are placed, they are also taken care of. So that transition ought to be driven by the state, and it has to involve the trade unions and other organizations of the working class in communities.
Thanks, Joe. That's a great note. Forward to a truly just energy transition.
Sure. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Just Us and the Climate, a production of the Climate Justice Coalition. To find out more about the coalition and our work to advance climate justice, visit climatejusticecoalition.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and share it widely. The more people it reaches, the more we can help grow the movement for climate justice.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.